5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The dark side of the Huddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom. On this Shelter in Place episode, we talk to Alex Glukowski, co-founder of Matter Labs. We discuss his backstory and hear how his parents had to flee Eastern European hyperinflation and how cash was king there. We discuss his political introduction to libertarianism and why it makes so much sense to him. We discuss his crypto awakening and whether or not he hodled. We also talk about Matter Labs and their roadmap for increasing scalability while remaining secure and private with zero knowledge proofs, and some other tools they've developed. We learn about some other projects he's hyped on, and get his take on MakerDAO's Black Thursday Black Swan event. Hit play to hear all this off-chain, supported by Dark Side of the Huddle Moon's Lunar Bull Crypto Knowledge Protocol. You are now orbiting the dark side of the Huddle Moon.
Brought to you by SpectreCoin. SpectreCoin is a proof of anonymous state coin. So it's got ring signatures, it's got stealth addresses, it's got a Tor obfuscation already built in. And like I mentioned, it's a staking coin. So this is a passive income coin. If you just hold and stake, you receive more coins. It is ultra secure, ultra private. Your financial privacy is at stake. Like Bitcoin, but private. Like Monero, but with staking. SpectreProject.io.
Stand by. Dark Side of the Huddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye of the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iTheSound.com. And we're back with another episode of Dark Side of the Huddle Moon. I'm Blockade, and I'm here with Josh again today, our amazing co-host. Josh, how are you doing today?
All right, Cade, I'm doing well. Thank you very much for having me on again. Oh, I'm on every week, actually. What a surprise. So how's it going? Unfortunately, the bad news has probably got to everyone already, but this coronavirus hasn't gone away, and it's affecting the global markets, like, in a big way.
Yeah, definitely. We've got a lot of big news in the world right now. The coronavirus, we've got the recent Black Swan event in the MakerDAO ecosystem, and other big news is Blockade is now rocking an amazing blonde mustache. But yeah, we're not going to be able to cover all those topics today, but we're definitely going to have to talk about MakerDAO and the liquidity crisis there and what it was doing with the DeFi loan system. And Josh, are you having a liquidity crisis there in Korea these days?
Actually, there is never a liquidity crisis in South Korea when it comes to soju or any liquor. When they're like the number one consumer of liquor in the world. And I think actually they're number two behind some brand of Russian vodka. But in terms of liters of alcohol that are consumed by adults, Koreans crush everybody. I think that they drink like 20 liters of hard liquor per person. So liquidity crisis, not so much, but it depends what type of liquidity you're talking about. What type of liquidity are you talking about, Cade?
Well, it's evening where you are, but it's early morning where I am. So I'm talking about coffee. And if I ever have a liquidity crisis, I just yell at my girlfriend, make me some more coffee now. But anyways, let's talk about our special guest today. We have a really interesting guest. It's Alex Glukowski. He's the co-founder of Matter Labs. Alex, how are you doing today?
Thanks. I'm great and very excited to be here with you.
Yeah, and Alex is a very hard worker. He's sheltering in place on permanent quarantine in his office, doing very great work in the DeFi space. And before we get into this amazing work you're doing, we want to learn a little bit about you. So can you kind of fill us in on your backstory, where you were born, what your passions were growing up, hobbies, sports, anything, where you moved, how you got into the crypto space? You can really take it wherever you'd like to.
Yep. So let's start. I was born in Soviet Union, and I grew up in Ukraine right after the Soviet Union break apart. And I experienced all the kind of things, like various crises of that era. So I remember shops being completely empty with no goods on the shelves. I remember hyperinflation in Ukraine in early 90s, where prices would rise by 20-30% daily. And we would all become millionaires overnight. So these things made a deep impression on me. Then I studied computer science in Kyiv. Then I moved to Germany and spent the last 15 years in Germany. Also studied computer science there. Worked in software industry in various applications of software. And it's interesting, when I moved to Germany, at first, I thought that the problems I saw in Ukraine were kind of black and white. So either you have a system which is corrupt, and the problems are all due to corruption, and then you have a beautiful Western capitalism where everything just works. But then I got exposed to libertarian ideas, and I grew more and more libertarian in my persuasion, and it looked like Germans, with all their bureaucracy and lots of regulations, actually are on the path to similar problems which we experience in Ukraine, just in a less accelerated fashion. And this is something which brought me to crypto eventually. I first learned about Bitcoin around 2009, I think summer 2009. I read an article with explanation, and I was fascinated by the technical aspects. But also as libertarian by the economic and freedom kind of things which were attached to it. But then I remember thinking to myself, it's a nice story. If we only could back it by gold somehow, maybe it would work. But then I had to reconsider it around 2013 when I saw the price soaring. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh, wow, it's not a toy. I should have invested back then. So I got deep into Bitcoin. I was, I didn't have much fortune back then, but I invested a large part of my fortune in Bitcoin there. Unfortunately, I had to sell most of it a couple of years ago at big discount. Back to my story. I was working in the software industry. As a kid, I wanted to become an inventor. Then it translated to being an engineer. And then I was growing the career of manager. And I realized that probably one of the most impactful ways you can change the world is to become an entrepreneur. When you think about problems, think about solutions, it's kind of a combination of technology, psychology, economics, like all these things, how you organize people together. So I ended up becoming founder of a startup. We were doing something similar to ClassPass for Germany, like a service for sports and different leisure activities subscription. And it was around that time that my fascination for Bitcoin grew for.
Wow, that's very interesting. And a lot of people forget about the Ukrainian crisis. Me and Josh talk a lot about issues with Venezuela and Zimbabwe and other crazy inflation stories, but a lot of people forget about the Ukrainian crisis, myself included. And it's interesting you kind of gravitated towards libertarianism. You know, European libertarians are kind of like unicorns. You don't meet a whole lot of them. So can you kind of tell me how you got into like libertarian philosophy or politics?
I was exposed to these ideas. I think a lot of people do not get exposed. So I was lucky to have friends who gave me right literature. I started by reading Henry Hazlitt, The Economics in One Lesson. It was very profound. And then a series of lectures by Bob Lefevre. And he's very entertaining. It was a really fun listening. And I just started paying more attention to what's going on. and looking at second order effects of the actions politicians make. And it became more and more apparent. So I think if you have critical thinking and you're open for new ideas, and you can take time and actually analyze and go through step by step and look at things from the perspective of individual actors, the libertarianism, or at least the point of view of Austrian economics, will inevitably stick to you in one way or another.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, there's not a lot of freedom outposts these days. You know, it even seems like, I would say the U.S. is kind of an outpost when it comes to freedom and libertarianism, but we're starting to go the way of Europe. You've got maybe Singapore, Hong Kong, Switzerland. But yeah, I think a lot of people have never even heard of these ideas, and maybe Josh can chime in here. But when I was in Korea and I mentioned like things like libertarianism and anarchism in Korean, I was saying it, they didn't even know what the word was in Korean. They had never even heard of the ideas. They had no clue at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I think that what we've seen over the past, since the fall of the Soviet Union, is like a clamoring for power by essentially technocrats and middle managers and people that want to basically assert their position of power onto masses of people. I think this type of class really was personified in the UK really well with someone called Tony Blair. You might have heard of him. He basically came up with the concept of making sure that everyone was generally the same, as long as that the state was in control and the experts were in control. And this type of thing really does harken back to the age of the Soviet Union itself. And unfortunately, with all types of communism, when you've got limited groups of people with limited information making massive decisions that they can't possibly know all of the different ramifications for, you have these second order effects like you mentioned. And another way of putting that is basically unintended consequences. I mean, you might have the best intentions, but as they always say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I think that is a really big lesson. I think that we've talked about this before a few times, Cade. But going back to you, Alex, in the Ukraine, you actually said that you grew up through basically some of these events, these second order effects, where some politicians or some Politburo members made some decisions and then it had far-reaching unintended consequences for you as a child. Do you remember what it was like growing up, specifically any type of moment that you can really reflect back on and think, wow, there's something not quite right here? Was there anything that stands out?
Well, I was a little child, so it's a little difficult for me to come back with emotional imprints from that time. But what I can say is, it's interesting that most people didn't learn the lesson. They still rely on government a lot, and I think it's due to massive indoctrination and the education system and compulsory schooling. But nonetheless, there is a lot less trust in the government. So nobody, people would not use banks to make purchases of large amounts of money. Like if you sell an apartment, you would do it with a suitcase full of US dollars, not with US hryvnia, not with Ukrainian hryvnia. People would not keep their life savings in the bank unless they're absolutely gullible. So this kind of, there is a good basis for libertarian ideas to grow in Ukraine. And there is a even better basis for, technologies or for means like crypto, for example, to take on once the state institutions are not functional anymore.
And nice. Definitely. And actually, the U.S., maybe you guys don't even know, they recently just passed a $2 trillion aid package. So even people in the U.S. are starting to rely on the government. They're not being responsible. I want to get into crypto, but I have one quick follow-up question for Alex. Does Germany have a libertarian party? And if so, do they have any seats in the government at all?
Germany has a libertarian party. It's a very small, very marginal one. They don't have any seats. the only party which is a little closer to libertarian ideas than the rest is FDP or the Liberal Party. But they're still very, very social democratic in their nature, like far more than Democrats in America, for example. And in Germany, people on average trust government a lot more. People look up to government to solve the problems. So like this is, I think, part of German mentality, to trust authorities and to rely on experts for things.
Hey, Alex, you know who I trust? Bitcoin and crypto. Anyways, let's talk more about your crypto journey. So you read about it relatively early, like 2009 or 10 or really early, and then you bought some and you had to sell some. So can you kind of tell me what kept you interested in crypto when you first heard about it and bought it and sold it? Was it to make money? Was it for political reasons? Was it you were really into the technology and maybe how it could change the world? Was it kind of a combination of all those reasons? We see a lot of different reasons why people get into crypto. A lot of times it's their programmers, their cypherpunks, their libertarians or anarchists. They're really into finance or sound money, like money that's backed by gold. So what got you interested in crypto and what kept you in crypto with all the swings in the market and its popularity going up and down, and now it's really coming into another resurgence? So what kept you in crypto? Like, what were the reasons?
So for me, the Bitcoin looked like a good alternative to the existing financial system, which was deeply corrupt by then. And we saw the consequences of 2008 crisis in full scale around that time. I bought the narrative of hyper Bitcoinization, and I thought like everybody is going to learn it just by the fact that Bitcoin price is going to go up and it's going to be inevitable that more and more people are going to buy in. And as I was CTO of a consumer startup around that time, I actually try to promote this idea and integrate Bitcoin payments, only to realize that I cannot do this because I had a list of priorities and each priority had a certain payoff. And I realized that if I integrate Bitcoin at this time, where very few people actually own it and spend, it's going to be a waste of resources of my startup. So I cannot do it. And if I cannot do it, probably nobody else can do it. So we have this massive chicken and egg problem. That in order to integrate Bitcoin as payment, you need merchants to adopt it, and then they will only adopt if users adopt it, but users have no incentive unless merchants have, and so on. So I thought, okay, we have to wait and see how it goes. So we have to wait at least that a lot of people simply own Bitcoin. But then there was the first big crisis in Bitcoin around 2015, I think. The price fell massively after a bubble burst, and it took way too long than I expected for the price to stabilize. So during that time, I needed some liquidity, and since I put most of my money into Bitcoin, I had to sell most of it. So I still kept some, but like very small amount because I...
Oh, you didn't hodl? You didn't hodl?
I didn't hodl. No,
most people didn't. Most people didn't.
Well, I thought, well, maybe it was actually a toy. Maybe this is not how things are going to work. Because Bitcoin was very inconvenient from the user experience point of view. So once Ethereum appeared and started to gain traction, and we had the concepts like stable coins and things like this, I thought that we have a second chance. And this is when I actually moved to crypto full time. Around like right after the DAO disaster in Ethereum, because I saw a big opportunity there to actually make at least some of the promises of crypto come true for the mass market and to get mass user adoption.
That's awesome that you went to crypto full time. So what do you think about when it comes to stable coins? They're stable in relation to a fiat currency. So most of the stable coins are backed one-to-one to the US dollar. but the US dollar's purchasing power is going down every year. So what do you make of that? Even if it's a stable coin, it doesn't fluctuate as much. Do you think there's still issues with stable coins?
Well, money has several functions, and one of them is medium of exchange, and it would be very inconvenient to denominate prices in Bitcoin. So it would still probably bind your prices at your e-shops or services to US dollar or any national currency which of the country you're offering the services in. So it would only make sense to have the settlement also done in some digital currency which reflects these prices. And we needed an interface from native crypto to this point of sale or merchant shops in order to make the crypto economy actually work. So for me, the stable coins are medium to this. So your savings are probably better off in crypto, although it's still a risky asset and you still want to balance risks. And at times like current, the prices can be very volatile. So you still want some proportion of cash, but you want to own this cash. You don't want it to be in the banks, which are at a very, very high risk to become to crack down, especially in the countries of the third world.
Yeah, well, now you can also have, with the DeFi space, you can have crypto stable coins that are backed to the dollar. You can have them in your wallet, or
exactly.
like you said, like old school, you have a suitcase full of cash. But yeah, everywhere I've went all around the world, especially like Southeast Asia, they'd prefer to get paid in dollars and not their native currency, which is pretty standard. And you kind of realize that the US is kind of the reserve currency. I think that's a perfect time to transition to the March 12th MakerDAO incident. So the DeFi space is new, it's growing, you know, things happen, there's hacks, but I think with every time something happens, the space gets stronger and the space learns about it, and they're improving and they're making things better. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what you make of the, not the MakerDAO hack, but the MakerDAO issues with the ETH price plummeting and the collateralized loans? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So this, the last Black Thursday was really fascinating. And if you can find some accounts, there are some really good stories, write-ups of what happened and why it happened. It's like a thriller. It's really interesting to read. And what happened was that the systems around MakerDAO were designed to withstand the crisis, but they were not tested under all conditions. So maybe we can make one step back and say that DAI or MakerDAO is a unique asset. Because it has the properties of cash, but it's completely backed by crypto and by decentralized Oracle and governance communities. And you can, like, it's a class of assets in itself, which has no comparisons, because nobody can take it from you. You completely own it. And at the same time, it has the stable properties. And these properties are based on this complex game theoretical incentives, which have to be enforced by interaction of many participants. So what happened on Black Thursday, the Ethereum ledger got congested due to massive surge in transaction throughput caused by prices plummeting, traders moving funds from exchanges to leverage the arbitrage opportunities, and also lots of orders being liquidated in DEXs and various DeFi protocols. And on the one hand, the system just didn't have the capacity to handle all the throughput, because we have a big scalability issue, which is what drew me into the... which was the reason why MetaLabs was founded in the first place, and we'll talk later.
Yeah, and congestion isn't good with MakerDAO, because there's certain time limits to bidding and
exactly
recollateralizing your loan. So if there's congestion on MakerDAO, that's going to create some serious issues.
But what's interesting, certain things did not work although they could have worked. So for example, some bots of MakerDAO could have had their transactions mined through if they increased the gas price accordingly, but they didn't increase the gas price. And the reason for this was that it was a very rare situation which wasn't properly tested because it appears so rarely. So as you mentioned earlier, this will make Maker and the entire community stronger. So we have this anti-fragile properties in the systems. People learn from it. We make better software. We can account for better critical emergencies. But what you actually want is to have these emergencies quite often. So you want to build systems in a way which exposes them to these things, and stress happens from time to time. So you don't want systems which have extremely long tails of on this black swan unfortunate events, which never trigger until it's a really, really bad case. This is interesting in application to different scaling approaches, which we currently have on Ethereum. And we can talk later about that as well.
Yeah, well, I think the fees were 100 times what they normally are on the Ethereum network. And for our listeners, that would maybe compare a little bit to when Bitcoin's fees were really crazy. It was like $30, $40, $50 to move your Bitcoin around. And actually, with that congestion, some really crazy things were happening. I heard that Ethereum with $0 bids was getting approved through congestion in the network because they were bidding $0. And if in a rational space, you'd bid more than $0 to get Ethereum. But because of the congestion you mentioned, people were getting basically free Ethereum by bidding $0.
That's correct. So people actually tried to bid against this $0 bids, but it didn't work, partly because they didn't know how to react, because it's a stressful situation. You cannot increase your bets indefinitely because your transaction might not be mined in time, and then you're just going to lose all the gas which you're offering, but partly because the software didn't support this option. So most people are willing to take risk, but they need some tools to process it properly.
Yeah, and in addition to that and the congestion issues, which we've already talked about, it was hard to source enough DAI. So the DAI market was illiquid too. So it was kind of a double whammy, but I did read that they kind of got together and deal with this crisis. They kind of changed some of the things. I think they backed it with a stablecoin as well, trying to do some fixes. So I kind of wanted to get your take. What are your thoughts of some of the fixes they took to kind of address these issues and address this black swan event?
Well, they added USDC as additional collateral at a very high interest rate so that it doesn't overload the system with lots of DAI being mined against another US dollar collateral. But in times like this crisis, you can go and flash loan yourself some DAI in order to use the arbitrage opportunities. So I think this was a good move on the Maker side, and it definitely boosted my confidence in the Maker ecosystem. Things will definitely get better after a crisis like this.
Yeah, definitely. Josh, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, a lot of thoughts, actually. I mean, there's a lot to unwrap there. You talked about a lot of things, and it really starts with throughput, right? And I think that this would be a great transition into, well, first of all, let's define what throughput is so that some of the newer listeners might be able to understand what it is. I would define it as just like being able to put things down a pipe, right? In a simple terms. But how would you define it, Alex? Throughput, because this is where it all starts, and then we can go into some of your projects with MATLABS.
So we can define it precisely as the number of transactions per second which a blockchain system can manage.
Right. So when you were first interacting with Bitcoin, and you wanted to basically have Bitcoin in your first startup, and you were like, all right, this is cool, I really like this as a technology, that's probably when you realized that the throughput just wouldn't be relevant for real world use. I mean, 7 transactions per second is nowhere near the current financial system. So
to be honest, I only realized that after the CryptoKitty crisis on Ethereum.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, I mean, Ethereum is only 25 transactions a second, approximately. So neither of Bitcoin or Ethereum, number one and number two, when it comes to people's mind share of cryptocurrencies, are anywhere close to ready for, let's say, real world adoption. But yet, when you saw all of the ICOs through 2017, even 2018, on everyone's lips was mass adoption, scalability. And I think this is really interesting, because what we've discussed essentially is a bubble within a bubble, because we're talking within a crypto world. Now we're talking DeFi, and we're talking about decentralized finance, which means that no one can control it, and it's completely open to anybody that wants to participate and build on it, which is what DeFi is all about. But the critical block for, let's say, mass adoption is that these things that are being built so far, they haven't been able to, if they were even popular, reach the mass market, because they don't have the capacity to do so. So what was it about, could you explain a little bit more your thoughts about how did you come to the conclusion, we've got to go after scalability, we've got to solve that problem, and then we could go into ZK sync and other stuff?
Yeah, so when I moved into crypto, at first I took some time to look around and learn and understand this new domain. And I was working as a consultant in Hong Kong for a year, going to all the crypto conferences and meeting people and learning and reading a lot of white papers and keeping learning all the basics. And it was already after the CryptoKitty congestion of Ethereum network and a few other events. And it was kind of clear already back then that there are a few problems which are holding the mass adoption. So one of them was obviously scalability, because if we compare crypto to systems like Visa or PayPal or other payment systems, it was very clear that we're nowhere near the actual demand. The second problem was usability. Like, how do you get ordinary users to actually to be able to use these things? And it came also with the question of security. So can you grant usability without losing all the valuable properties of crypto, which is self-custody and self-sovereignty and over your funds?
Yeah, and decentralization and permissionless systems.
Oh yeah, which, that's the prerequisite.
So we often call it the blockchain trilemma in many respects. So you've got scale is one problem, decentralization is another, and security is another. So often projects basically sacrifice one of those things. So Bitcoin's got decentralization, it's got security, but it doesn't have scale. But when you talk about, let's say, some permission systems, then they just basically sacrifice the decentralized aspect of this trilemma. And then Absolutely. Added on top of that is the UI UX problem, which you mentioned, the user interface and the user experience, which has to come if we're going to get this quote-unquote mass adoption. So the scale and the security and the decentralization, I mean, that's like the golden trinity right there, if we can come up with something that can solve that. Yeah, sorry to interrupt your train of thought, but yeah, go ahead.
No, you're absolutely right. So there was several approaches to solving all these problems, and the UX back then looked like the most well understood and the most solvable. Because we had approaches from the mobile applications and web 2.0, which could be brought over to crypto. And it was kind of clear what you can do. There was this ideas around about a smart contract based wallets and social recovery and the ways you can deal with your secret phrases and so on. So it was clear that somebody is going to solve it in a very short time. It actually took longer than I expected, but now we have pretty good solutions. So we have wallets like Argent and Zengo and Ethereum, which implement these ideas and do it pretty, pretty well. But the scalability was difficult. So as a technologist, I was looking in at the roots of the problem and at the technical solutions proposed. And you're absolutely right that most of the proposals were completely sacrificing the basic principles and values of crypto. So they would essentially go for more centralization and for or for less security or for both. So I was keenly looking for the proposals which would keep the true crypto nature. There were a few. One most promising one was the Plasma, invented by Vitalik Buterin and Joseph Poon. And when I saw Plasma, I thought, oh, now we have it. Eventually, it's going to be done. But it took approximately half a year into Plasma implementation, and the first underwater stones started to emerge, and it gradually became more clear that it's not a viable approach.
Yeah, didn't they just quietly get rid of Plasma? Like, they didn't really mention it, just kind of disappeared, right?
Well, the research was going on, and we had tried different ways to approach it from different angles. And eventually, it became apparent that Plasma is dead. But it kind of reincarnated in the idea of a roll-up. And the roll-up is something I deeply believe as the best way forward for us now. And this is what MatterLabs is working on. So ZK-SNP is actually a parent of.
All right, so can you explain for our listeners what a roll-up is and kind of get into the basics?
Let's say what a ZK is. So zero knowledge first, right? And then what's a roll-up?
Yeah, so I wanted to know like what a roll-up is, and can you explain what a zero-knowledge proof is or a zero-knowledge snark? Maybe you can talk a little bit of side-chain versus off-chain and kind of get into some of the basics so our listeners kind of have a good fundamentals before we start.
So let's try. Let's start with sidechains. A sidechain is an idea that you can have some state which is not stored on the main crypto ledger on Bitcoin or Ethereum, but instead is maintained by the participants on their databases. And on the main net, on the main ledger, on layer one, you only store a cryptographic commitment of the state. Usually it's a Merkle root, just a hash of your state, which represents the entirety of the state. So if you change just one bit in your state, this hash will change completely. And now you make all the changes in your databases. You coordinate somehow how you do these changes by applying transactions. You change the balances of different accounts. And then you would store a new hash on your layer one. And then you have some way to interact with this layer one. So essentially all the funds are stored on layer one in one account, along with this hash, which represents its state. But you also want to secure it somehow. Because if anybody can update this hash, what prevents them from storing a hash of a state where they all of a sudden own all of the money in the system, right? So you need some checks. So sidechains do these checks by requiring the majority of the operators of a sidechain to sign any changing transaction, which is a risky position because the majority can always collude to steal the funds from the minority and from other users. So you want something stronger than that. In crypto, we always want to verify and not trust. Okay. In Plasma, the idea was that any user can always observe what's going on this sidechain. And whenever an operator tries to commit an incorrect transaction, a fraudulent transaction, or simply transaction with an error, they can always go and protest on-chain and submit another transaction, which says like, oh, I want to appeal to the court, to Ethereum, in our case, for example, that this move was incorrect and we please need to revert it. The problem with Plasma was that the state had to be maintained off-chain, and there was no good way to guarantee that the users who would be monitoring the situation would get all the updates of the state. So this was the biggest problem. Call this problem data availability. There's no way to ensure data availability in a way which objectively attributes fault, because we have something like a speaker-listener dilemma. It's impossible to objectively convince you that I did not receive information, or like that somebody didn't give me the information. So maybe they gave me, but I didn't listen, right? So you can always do it subjectively. So I can tell you that this guy didn't give me the data. Then you can go to this guy, ask him, and if he doesn't give data to you, then you will know that I'm right and he's wrong, right? But it's not enough for a blockchain system, because in blockchain, we need a way to reach consensus on this, and there is no good way to reach consensus. So this is why Plasma failed. The only way to deal with data availability in Plasma was mass exit. So if some users would see no updates from the operators, they would have to go and all massively exit from the system within some period of time, which would cause a congestion and would also make the system vulnerable to dishonest operators who would just withdraw data and withhold data and just bring the system to halt. So the difference of rollup is that we actually ensure that data reaches all of the participants. We do it by publishing the data necessary to reconstruct the changes on the blockchain itself. However, we don't use the storage of the blockchain, and we don't use the computational capacities. We only use blockchain or blocks in Ethereum, in our case, for propagating this data. So this way we can ensure that everybody gets it, and they can protest if they see a problem. Or even better, in the case of ZK rollup, the operator has to present a zero knowledge proof that the transition was correct.
Nice, very good. So that was a lot of information. That was some great content. So if I wanted to sum it up in one sentence, could I call it an off-chain layer 2 solution built on Ethereum using ZK snarks and ZK proofs?
ZK rollup is what you described, yes.
All right, cool. Awesome. Josh, so go ahead.
What zero knowledge proofs are and how we use them. So zero knowledge proofs are cryptographic protocols which permit one party, the prover, to convince another party, the verifier, of some computational statement. So we can have some function, which might be very complex to evaluate and which might have some inputs which I want to keep private, but I can still compute the result of the function and present you with a result and a very succinct proof that this result is actually a result of the evaluation of this function from some set of arguments. So in other words, I can convince you of integrity of my computation. So we can, a better word for zero knowledge proofs would be proofs of computational integrity, how Elie Ben Sasson puts it. And the way it helps us is that the verification can be performed by the blockchain itself. So we can have a smart contract which performs some very simple mathematical operations and can check that the data which we presented was indeed derived from previous data in some correct way. We applied some proper transformation to this data. And this guarantees the security. So in ZK rollup, we make a state transition. So we change this cryptographic commitment to the state only if there exists some block, some number of transactions, which perform the transition from the previous state to this new one. And every single transaction is correct. It's correctly signed by the user. The users own the amount of funds which they wanted to spend, and so on. So we check all the rules which would otherwise be checked by the blockchain itself. And then we simply verify it.
Nice. So Would you agree with this statement that you're basically doing an off-chain layer 2 solution for scalability reasons, but you're building it on Ethereum for security reasons? Would that be a fair statement?
I would say that we inherit the security properties of the underlying layer 1. So if we do a ZK rollup on Ethereum, then we guarantee that the funds placed in ZK rollup would be as safe as though they were on Ethereum itself. However, we increase the throughput massively. So with ZK rollup, we can increase throughput multiple hundred times. So we can actually reach the throughput of Visa right now of thousands of transactions per second.
Yeah, this is exactly where I was hoping this was going to go next. And thanks for teeing that up, which is exactly the Visa scale throughput that you have been alluding to, which seems to be ready right now with ZK Sync. And as far as I'm aware, MetaLabs are not the owners, because it's everyone owns it together now, but you basically created it and you've put it out there open source now, people can see it. So ZK Sync was really fascinating to me when I first saw it, because the company that I work at in my day job, we were looking for scalability solutions. And this came across my desk maybe about 6 weeks ago. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. This is actually something that is going to really bring DeFi to the next level that it needs to go, especially considering the decentralized nature of what we're building here. Because, of course, you can scale stuff already. We've already got a scalable financial system that's centralized. Having a decentralized, scalable alternative to the centralized financial system is really what cryptocurrency is all about. So finding this was kind of really interesting to me, and thinking, okay, this is going to be awesome. I don't quite understand how it works. So if we could go into the ZK Sync side a little bit now, and also let's talk about MetaLabs a little bit. So before we talk about ZK Sync, we could talk about MetaLabs. So when did you set up MetaLabs, or was MetaLabs set up as a consequence of ZK Sync? I'm not sure about the sequencing there or the order.
So we started MetaLabs by starting to work on this ZK rollup solution, which eventually became branded as ZK Sync. And this is our main focus. So we're concentrating all efforts there. We started MetaLabs 1.5 years ago when I met my co-founder at DEF CON in Prague. And we raised a seed round last summer. And working fully now to bring ZK Sync to production as soon as possible, because we believe that we will, as a result of this crisis, we will probably need mass payment systems with crypto properties, scalability, and privacy sooner than expected. So, what is ZK Sync? ZK Sync is essentially an extension of Ethereum. So, from the end user perspective, and we place a lot of emphasis on end users and the usability for them, it's going to look something like a decentralized PayPal. So you have some account, somebody can send you money, or you can move money there from Ethereum. It can be any token, can be ETH, it can be DAI, it can be any stablecoin or whatever you want. And you can just send it to somebody else. And then you can interact with smart contracts. And we gradually want to improve it, starting with scalability, but then moving towards privacy and support of generic smart contracts in this ecosystem.
Nice. I noticed that you, in one of your posts, you have a lean design philosophy, introducing features one by one versus rolling them out all at the same time. So why do you choose to do them one by one versus a batch of all of them at the same time? What is your thought process on that?
Because you will want to learn as much as possible from the feedback from the users. So you want to understand what market really needs and what features are important and which ones are just vanity and people actually don't want them. So you want this constant flow of feedback just in time.
Nice. And I've had this question in my head for a while now. So you built on Ethereum. So why did you choose not to make your own blockchain? And why did you choose Ethereum over some other chain? You know, Cardano and these other competitors are working on the scaling too. So it seems like most of the big projects are building on Ethereum these days. So why did you choose Ethereum versus some other options?
Well, ideally, would have preferred Bitcoin because you want a system which is which has the highest security properties. But Bitcoin would not allow us to build a layer two solution with zero knowledge proofs. There are primitives missing, and at the current pace of Bitcoin innovation, I don't expect to see them in any observable future. So the next best option was Ethereum. And the reason we decided to build on Ethereum and not doing our own blockchain is that any layer one blockchain will eventually compete with other layer one blockchains, and the network effects are immensely powerful. So you would have to bootstrap the entire ecosystem with the DeFi and stablecoins and oracles and everything. And by building on Ethereum, we simply grab all of this. We can instantly use all tokens available on Ethereum in ZK Sync. We can pass messages from Ethereum smart contracts to ZK Sync and so on. So we're just plugging in into existing ecosystem, and I think it's the fastest way to get it's actually the safest way to get to adoption.
Yeah, definitely. I think building your own blockchain, it's very ambitious, and it's a lot to take on. Wouldn't you say so, Josh?
Well, that's why a lot of projects, even the let's say the private ones, are building on some type of Ethereum, private Ethereum. So you've got Hyperledger Base, so you've got Quorum by JP Morgan. These are private forks of Ethereum. So, I mean, you've had a lot of development on the Ethereum network already, so you don't need to reinvent the wheel. If you're trying to start from scratch, I mean, it will take hundreds of millions of dollars in this day and age now, so it doesn't really make sense to start from zero, especially when you've got I can't even quantify how many hours of labor have gone into the Ethereum network at this point of time. Same with EOS and same with Cardano, but I think Ethereum is leading the way. There are some others like Cosmos that are pretty interesting as well. But on that particular thing, I think Ethereum is leading the way in terms of the amount of developers that are deciding to, of their own free will, get involved and contribute code. So that's pretty good. And I think that's what really makes it stand out, because when you see Vitalik, if you've met him, or if you've, he's not really a sociable guy, but if you've seen him speak, he has a little following everywhere he goes, and I think that is also helpful for promoting the development on Ethereum as well. So
on the other hand, ZK-Sync is layer one agnostic. So we don't make a bet only on Ethereum. If it turns out that some other blockchains are popular for some maybe specific applications, or in general are getting more traction, we can always build on those blockchains as well.
Okay, that's good. That's good to clarify that. So you could potentially, if you wanted to, look at a different blockchain, I don't know, pick one, EOS or Cosmos, and you could modify it a little bit, but the same type of rules would apply there.
Exactly. Bulk of the code will remain, only the part which interacts with the blockchain, which is the thin smart contract layer, would have to be added for specificity of that blockchain.
All right, cool. There's one question that I have, and I don't know if it's accurate or not, but maybe you could dispel this myth, if it is a myth, or just maybe clarify what is going on with it. I heard that the the feeling of using ZK-Sync is that it's instant, but the only downside is that potentially confirmations might take up to 20 minutes. Could you let me know, is that true? And why is that, if that is true? And is that a big issue or not?
So we have to differentiate within the final verification on the layer one, which gives you the maximum security, and the convenience for end users, for which we provide the instant confirmations, backed by some security collateral. So once you have a transaction with an instant confirmation, you still have some probability that this block will be reverted and then there might be a double spend. So you're still taking some risks. Although the security this security bond is supposed to be very high, so that it's not going to be profitable to try to double spend on you in any way. However, once you have your transaction verified and the zero knowledge proof generated, you have the same security as the underlying blockchain, Ethereum or whatever. So if you are receiving a $1 million transaction, you're probably going to wait a little longer to have this final verification. But if you're just being paid for coffee, you're probably absolutely fine walking away with $10, because somebody would have to burn $1 million in order to steal this 10 bucks from you.
Right.
So this is a security trade-off, which you as a user take and you decide yourself.
Okay, that makes sense. And thanks for clarifying that. That's good. I'd like to ask you about the process of getting the seed round. I mean, that was like maybe going back to September when you and your co-founder decided, all right, let's put our ideas out there. And was that an arduous thing to do, as I imagine mainly a developer, but then having the knowledge and the kind of conviction that you have, was it fun? Was it annoying? Was it difficult? Or was it actually quite straightforward because the idea was so needed in the market? I mean, I know that scalability has been the number one question since early 2018, at least. So when you had the idea for basically the solution to this issue, was it very straightforward in terms of, here's the idea, here's how it's going to work, now we just need some funding? And I saw that you got some funding from the Ethereum Foundation and then some others as well. What was it like going out and raising money? Because that's a bit different than just what a normal developer would do.
So we indeed received a grant initially from the Ethereum Foundation, and I'm really grateful to people from the foundation who facilitated this grant, which was very important for us to get the first prototype done. It was pretty straightforward after that. Initially, the investors were pretty skeptical because of the technical issues. So back then, we didn't have... the zero knowledge proofs were not in a state which would allow to use them in production. So they were very new. We have some problems with existing proof systems. They required an application-specific trusted setup, which would be very, very annoying and would might be difficult to convince users in the security of such an enterprise. But then... it all started to change with more breakthroughs in the zero knowledge research. So we had a system, a proof system called Sonic from Sean Ball from Electric Coin Company, which was the first hint at how things might look like in the near future. So we were actually one of the first companies to implement a prototype of Sonic. And then last summer, we had what people call the Cambrian explosion in zero knowledge proof protocols, with a few very good protocols emerging, having very, very nice properties, both in terms of performance as well as the convenience and security of how they were structured, because we didn't need an application-specific trusted setup anymore. We could do once and for all a trusted setup with a lot of credible participants, with people like Vitalik Buterin and many companies, all contributing to the security of this protocol. And if at least one of them was honest, then the whole thing would work. And of course, it's very reasonable to expect that not only one of them, but like actually a lot of them would be honest. So after these changes, it was, I think there was a change in investor sentiment, and it was pretty easy for us to close around there.
Yeah, and also too, like the early round, there's always people willing to take those risks, because there may be, it may be riskier, but high risks, high rewards as well. So there's always people that are willing to fund ambitious projects. And it looks like for some of your investors, that could definitely pay off. I kind of want to roll back to ZK Sync a little bit. So maybe just to kind of summarize it, it seems like it's very secure. You've got high throughput, really fast confirmations. And most important, it's you've got private smart contracts, and it's very censorship resistant. Is there anything else you want to cover? Do you want to talk about the guardians or validators or anything we kind of missed today when it comes to ZK Sync or anything else with Matter Labs?
So first of all, I want to set the expectations properly, because what we described in the in this post was the vision for ZK Sync, which is the eventual state. So we are currently not there yet. We are working gradually to add these features. And
okay, so that's like kind of like the roadmap.
This is the roadmap, and this is a very strong vision. So we know exactly what we want to build, where we want to get. This is important, and this vision was born out of looking at the end users and imagining what the end user experience should be like in order for this thing to get a shot at mass adoption. And currently we're focusing on payments and transfers of tokens, and we want to add privacy and smart contracts later. And eventually, we're going to add the full-fledged decentralization with guardians, because censorship resistance is really, really important. But it's important. It's second in priority to the actual functionality, because the security in our system, unlike many other scaling solutions, doesn't depend on the number of validators or the number of operators in the system. So even with one operator, it's completely safe.
Okay, so with your design philosophy, like you said, you're going in order one by one. Even though it's kind of in the roadmap, can you talk a little bit about guardians and validators and how they work? We actually haven't covered that on the podcast yet. So can you explain that system a little bit for people that aren't familiar with it?
So the validators are actors who will produce zero-knowledge proofs. So they are block producers. They will take transactions, aggregate them in blocks, commit these blocks on Ethereum, and also produce your knowledge proofs, which require some intense computational resources to get produced. And because of these properties, you cannot have too many of the validators. So it's reasonable to have around 100, maybe, similar to the way permission blockchain or like permissionless blockchains with delegated proof of stake are structured, like Cosmos and EOS and so on. But we want to go one step further, and we can afford that. So we can have a lot more users, similar to how full nodes are run on Ethereum. Users who run a low security version of the nodes, which can be run on ordinary machines, we call these users guardians. And the sole purpose of the guardians is to prevent censorship. So what they do is they monitor the transaction flow on the network, or at least the fraction of this flow. And if they detect transactions which should have been included in the block, but were not, despite having free capacities, they will know that these transactions are being censored. And then they can withdraw their vote from the validators and give the vote to the validators who actually include transactions in order to make sure that they are all going to be eventually mined. So an interesting difference to systems with delegated proof of stake is that our guardians do not need to secure these nodes that much. So they can actually they're complete analog of the full nodes in Ethereum. It makes it possible to have a lot of users with normal laptops.
Okay, so that really does open it up to the average users getting involved and helping to bring speed, but not necessarily security. They're not adding to the security side, but they're helping the transaction scalability side. One thing I heard about was essentially this might be a problem to do with like the write speed of solid state drives or something of that nature. Is that true, or is that just misinformation on my end?
So whenever you have a stateful system and a node which operates in this stateful system, you have to remember the state, and you have to read the state. And obviously, you need high-profile hardware like solid-state drives in order to be able to do it quickly. So this would be a requirement for the validators. We would expect the validators to have powerful machines, high broadband internet, fast I/O capabilities with solid-state drives. And they would produce the blocks as soon as possible. And they would coordinate in the internal consensus to produce blocks quickly, as fast as one block per second. But the guardians do not need to store any state. They only need to monitor a fraction of transactions. So it puts the requirements on their end much, much lower.
All right. So now, bringing this back to the kind of the real world stuff about the Visa scale, one block per second and then 2,000 transactions per block, would that be realistic to expect from ZK Sync on top of Ethereum?
That's approximately how it would look now. So the bottleneck is the throughput capacity of Ethereum. So not the zero knowledge proof part, not the consensus on our side, but actually how much data we can put on Ethereum in order to make this data available to the users. So this number is also expected to grow once we have ETH 2.0, because we will have more shards and maybe even more data per shard. But this will probably remain the bottleneck.
All right, cool. Well, it's been really fascinating so far, so I've found it really good. So thanks for sharing all this information so far. But let's talk a little bit about some more light topics, because, I mean...
Wait. I gotta ask him about Zinc, though, first.
Oh, yeah, go on then. Let's keep it heavy.
Yeah, just last one, Josh, don't worry. I'll pop open another beer, you'll be okay. All right. So, Zinc, you've created Zinc, a programming language that's a simplified version of Rust that makes the creation of zero-knowledge proof circuits easy. And that seems like another bottleneck, is there's not enough programmers. So, you claim that you can learn it in one day if you're familiar with Rust, C++, or Solidity. And we've interviewed someone else on the podcast that did JTherium, which allows them to make smart contracts without knowing Solidity. So, can you talk a little bit about Zinc, and then we'll transition on?
Sure. So we have, in order to construct zero knowledge proofs, you need a special domain-specific language. It's not possible currently to do it with standard languages because there are some nuances which you have to take into account. Let's not deep dive into this now, but let's just say we need this separate language. And the languages which are currently existing are, we found them not to be fit for production purposes. They were mostly academic or educational or good for prototyping, but not good for writing secure applications or, say, smart contracts. So we realized we have to build one. And we didn't want to overload people with learning new semantics and just learning another language. So we picked Rust as probably the most popular language among security professionals as of today. So we stripped it of some elements which make Rust complicated. So now it's indeed learnable for anybody who is coming from the smart contract background. And this language can be used for creating smart contracts on zk-sync. But it can also be used to creating general purpose zero knowledge circuits or zero knowledge proof programs. And this can be used for a broad range of applications in privacy and other things. So we expect it to be widely used also outside of ZK Sync ecosystem.
Nice. I think that's really interesting. My coffee refill is cryptographically secure, but I'm all out of questions. So Josh, it's all you from here on out.
Yeah, man. I was just gonna before we wrap this up, just have some lighter questions, really. And it's more about the projects that you're interested in apart from what you're working on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, we've covered a lot of stuff today, and it's been really fascinating. But maybe there's some other topics that you'd like to touch on briefly before we call this a day. So are there any other projects that you're interested in the cryptocurrency space that you'd like to talk about briefly? Or just let us know.
Yeah. What projects do you wish you were an early investor in? And if you want to give a shout out to some other projects you're a big fan of, that'd be great. We want to spread the cryptographic wealth here.
So I'm of course really excited about all projects in the zero knowledge proof space. I think that all of them are doing a great job. So starting with Starkware, who has people who invented some of the zero knowledge proofs, we have Artstack, O1 Labs with Coda. Really excited about the progress of sorry, we have to cut that. I forgot the name.
No, that's all right.
Oh, no. No worries.
That's fine. I mean, it's been over an hour. It's all good. That's brilliant so far, honestly, man. This has been so in-depth and really enjoyed it.
Give me 1 second. I'll remember the name.
You were just talking about O1 Labs. Yeah.
Let me restart this. Right?
Yeah, sure. So
go. 3, 2.
So obviously I'm very excited about other projects in the zero knowledge proof space, starting with Starkware, who has some scientists who invented part of the zero knowledge proofs, which we're currently using, Zcash, who laid the basis for the software libraries and utilities, which come into use in ZK Sync as well. Artstack, who is working on privacy stuff. O1 Labs with Coda. I'm really excited about the progress of Loopring in bringing ZK rollup technology to decentralized exchanges. But I'm also very, very excited about other projects in crypto who are working on making crypto more mass adoptable. And in the first line, it's the wallets. So I wish I was early investor in Argent, for example, but also in other wallets which are doing security and user-centric approach to the experience, such as Zengo and Ethereum and others. And of course, the DeFi space in general. Because
it's an exciting space. And in the big scheme of things, we're all early, really. I mean, even though this industry is like, I don't know, just past 10 years recently, Bitcoin white paper 2009, we come out with a new decentralized way of doing finance, and then we're a decade into it and people think, I'm too late for this show. No, the show's just getting started, really. And it's projects like yours that will bring it to the mainstream, because we need that scalability on top of decentralized and secure blockchains, because otherwise, I mean, it defeats the point. So I'm very excited about DeFi, especially in, and I always hammer this every episode, and I will for the whole of 2020, especially in the places that don't have already good financial infrastructure. I mean, we don't need New York, London, Singapore, and Hong Kong to be the new hubs of cryptocurrency, because that's where the hub of finance is already. And that's where all the problems originated from in the first place, that created this need for a decentralized alternative. So I think it's going to be the places like Manila, Philippines, Bangkok, Thailand, I don't know, Cape Town, South Africa, Sao Paulo, Brazil. These are the places where you're going to have these developing economies. We've got people with phones, don't have access to the traditional financial system, can now interact with finance thanks to decentralized financial opportunities brought to the world by cryptocurrency.
Definitely. And we know with our last few guests, you know, we've been talking to all really DeFi guests, and it's really interesting. And I think 2020 is the year it really takes off. Well, I've never heard of Argent before. I'll definitely have to check it out. If my French serves me correctly, I think Argent is French for money. So maybe they're a team out of France. I don't know. Well, wow, that was really a great interview. I'm all out of questions. I think Josh is too. So I guess Alex will leave you with the last words if there's anything else you want to talk about with your company or anything else, and then we'll wrap it up today.
I think we covered most of the things which were interesting. So I just want to wish everybody good health, and I'm very confident that eventually things will come back to normal and we'll be even better after this crisis. So just want to send some positive vibes to people who are under lockdown.
That's good.
Nice.
Especially in these times, everyone is under quarantine. So hopefully by the time you listen to this, the curtain is lifting a little bit and the quarantine is going to be maybe easing up a little bit.
Definitely. I think everyone should stay locked down at home and definitely lock up your private keys. And when we're talking about throughput and scalability, Josh doesn't know this yet, but I've been working on our own throughput and scalability solution. And actually now our podcast is capable of 1,000 listeners per second, but we're actually going to try to scale up to 100,000 listeners per second in 2020. So until next time, we'll see you guys on the dark side
of the HODL moon.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the HODL Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehodlmoon.com. HODL Moon!